The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Tom Lynn. He's got a new novel out. It's called Babylon, South Dakota. He joins us on the telephone, not too far away from South Dakota. He's in Iowa City. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom, tell me about it. How did you get the idea for this story?
It's a combination of a lot of things. So I was hearing all these family stories from my grandparents and my parents. And while I was writing it, my grandfather was actually, he was getting sick from COVID and he was in and out of the hospital. And so he was feeling really nostalgic and kind of telling us all these stories, and everyone was kind of in a reminiscent mood. And so I had collected all these like snippets of stuff from, you know, their childhoods in China, what it was like to immigrate, what they remembered. And at the same time that I was writing the book, I was actually also doing my PhD at the University of California, Davis, which is about science fiction and nuclear missiles. And so while I was hearing these stories and kind of taking them down in my notebook, I was also visiting, disused missile silos. I was interviewing old rocket engineers. I was traveling, Florida to San Diego to South Dakota, in fact, going to all these sites. And, the two things kind of came together in my head. I wanted to make something that could hold all that together at once. Not only my family stories, but also this kind of fascination with these devices that we've built that can bring about the end of the world. And I think it was also useful to have it because it was a distraction for my dissertation, which at that point was just killing me. And so this way I could have two things that I could get stuck on at the same time rather than just one.
Science fiction and nuclear missiles. Explain your fascination.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been interested in science, or I've always kind of been fascinated with the way that things work. I think that I have this kind of really distant fear, or maybe this belief that it's someday I will be called upon to rebuild everything that ever existed, and I'll need to know how everything works in order to do that. I used to like take apart stuff as a kid and try my best to put it together. And so I always really loved learning about the world. Everything that I learn, I find amazing. And I like to kind of collect knowledge. And I also like books, and I didn't really like doing science. I just like learning about science. And so that's how I kind of got into this PhD that was focused on science and technology studies, which is exactly what I wanted, which is you get to talk and think about science, but you don't actually have to get grants and be in a lab and do science. But at the same time, I think this desire of mine to learn everything that I could about a particular thing, it really meets a total brick wall when it comes to nuclear information. Because that is the one thing that you can't know everything there is to know about it unless you sign a bunch of documents, and then you can't tell anybody about it. And so I was kind of trying to figure out what that meant, even for American fiction, like the way that we think about these things that only some people get to know about and which, like it or not, comes to affect all of us, right? The consequences of nuclear war is consequences for everybody, and not just the select few who know about it. And for me, the only way to close that gap between how much I wanted to know about it and how much I was allowed to know about it was through fiction and even through scholarly research as well. That by kind of writing my way across that rupture, I'd be able to capture it in my head and make it safe for me to think about. Because I mean, it's a horrible thing to think about, right? Nuclear war. And I think for many people, the hearing about nuclear weapons, the response is, well, that's awful, and I'd like not to hear any more about it. And for me, I was like, I need to know everything about it in order to be able to go on living. And the only way that I could know everything about it was to make stuff up, which is, I think, in a kinder way of saying it, is just writing fiction.
Well, anybody born after 1945 has been shadowed by the threat of nukes. My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and after the Japanese surrender, they sent him into Nagasaki to survey the damage. He never talked about it. But I feel the shadow, and I think we all do. They say, oh, we haven't used these since then, but they certainly like to brandish them. What were you going to say?
Oh, I mean, we have it in our bones, right? Like the isotopes that were created by that explosion in 45, but also by all the hundreds of nuclear tests, they produce isotopes of chemicals that we've incorporated into our bodies. Like you can test if old wine is legitimate by testing for those isotopes. Like everyone on Earth, everything on Earth is marked by those bombs, like it or not.
Wow, so this is a fake Bordeaux? Oh, man. I never heard that. So they're corked and they can pull out the wine and go, no isotopes, it's real.
Yep, and actually for a while we were looking for, we would pull steel from sunken battleships because the process of making steel, you have to blow huge amounts of air over the ore as you're making it. And air now contains radioactive isotopes from the nuclear explosions, which means that you can't use them to make sensitive scientific instruments that detect radiation because the you can't make the box detecting radiation itself be radioactive. And so for a while there was a small trade in salvaging steel from old battleships which were built before 1945 because they had it's called low background steel.
Wow. Gosh, Tom, I'm learning a lot here. The book is Babylon, South Dakota. Tom Lynn wrote it. He joins us on the phone in Iowa City. Beautiful Johnson County, Iowa. All right, set this up. Tell us how you structured the story, and let's talk about your protagonists.
Yeah, so the story, I think, it's been very hard to pitch because it is really, and I know everyone likes to say this about their own books, but you really have to, I think you have to read it to understand it. The general premise is that we have Saul and May. They're two Chinese immigrants. They come, they inherit a homestead in South Dakota in like the mid 70s, and they move to that homestead and they begin building a life. They have a daughter and they start setting up a farm and a ranch. And as they do that, the U.S. government comes by and they install a nuclear missile silo on their property. And they begin doing some odd research there. And then from there, strange and miraculous things begin happening. For me, it's a book about mortality and immortality and about love and what we owe to each other. And I've heard it pitched as Fargo meets Lost. I've been saying for a little while, I've been saying Stranger Things, season one, plus East of Eden. If you have another combination, I'd love to hear it. It's a difficult book to kind of talk about. And it's hard to feel sympathy for me because I wrote the thing.
Yeah. Well, I never have to pitch books. I talk about them and I review them. And for this one, all I'd say is, it's the most beautiful book you're going to read this year. That would be my pitch.
Thank you, Vic. That's staggeringly high praise. Well, I'm really grateful for that.
When I started reading it, I just you sucked me in, and I just man, I'm telling you, when we get to the part where we meet the dog, I mean, anybody that doesn't just melt down, oh man, unbelievable.
Yeah, and for those of us, for those of you listening, I hope the dog doesn't die. No harm comes to the dog.
Thank you. And the dog, the only question I have about the dog is this one. At one point, Saul goes to sleep for quite a while. And where's the dog?
Oh, he's out. He's out and about. He's a ranch dog. He goes down and follows everybody else around. Yeah.
All right. Because I'm picturing him asleep and the dog going up and like nuzzling him. Like, come on, wake up, dude.
Do you have a dog?
No.
We've got a dog at home, and she knows when we're sleeping. And so you can't fool her. When you wake up in the morning, she'll kind of smell you, and she can smell if your breathing changes, I guess. And then once she knows you're awake, she'll start, whining and asking us to go out. And I think I kind of imagine that for the dog, going up to Saul and kind of checking if he's in and kind of knowing as dogs do that Saul is out and can't be roused and then picking something else to do.
I was just tweaking you, Tom. okay. Let's talk about First of all, let's talk about Saul. Because Saul carries the weight of the world, and he's married to this incredible woman, and they have this amazing daughter. And Saul, he's kind of us, I think. He's the reader, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, Saul is, I mean, he's, I think, for me, the major character aspect of Saul is that he tries his best. And even when he knows that his best might not be good enough, he can't forgive himself if he doesn't try. And I think that haunts him, you know. There's moments where we see him, he wishes he could have been braver, or he could have said the right thing, or he wouldn't have been so impulsive, or he had just thought for a little bit, and those moments haunt him. I think he's kind of dogged by this fear that he'll be found out as being not good enough or a coward. And I think the real triumph, and I don't even know if he comes to realize this in the end, the triumph is that everyone in his life loves him. And they think that he's so loving and he's so kind. And I think for me, that's all of us, right? Is that we fear that we will be judged for our darkest moments and for our weakest decisions. And we're not, because everyone, I think, carries that same fear. And so when we look at others, we see people who seem to be so much more righteous or kind of kind than we are, and we want to be like them, and to kind of realize that we're all trying our best, and that sometimes we succeed and sometimes we don't, I think is at the core of this book. It's a striving and a failing and a beauty in that failing.
You're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. I've been joined by Tom Lynn. We're talking about his novel Babylon, South Dakota. And they arrive from China out in the middle of nowhere in South Dakota, and they've brought some precious things with them. He's brought some chrysanthemum seeds, and they've also smuggled some gold. And these become enduring things that take us through the novel, the gold and the chrysanthemums. And in the case of the flowers, it's kind of like the trouble with tribbles.
The chrysanthemums grow kind of totally wild all over the ridge as soon as they get the first opportunity.
And then there's... go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, they end up adapting to the environment. So they come in and they're very fragile and they're like ornamental flowers. And then they somehow survive a series of increasingly harsh and impossible winters. And the ones that do survive then proliferate like tribbles into this kind of mess of varieties that end up doing all sorts of stuff.
And by the end of the book, you've merged these two precious items, but we'll leave that for readers to discover. And there aren't that many peripheral characters in this. I usually fall in love with a peripheral character, and if I had to pick one in your book, I think it would be the doctor. But we have a character named Abram, who, to my point of view, is the hero of the story, yet he's also on the verge of insanity.
Yeah. Yeah, Abram is a character that he truly believes in what he's found out and what he's learned. And I think he's the limit case, right? Of like, how much faith do you have in this thing that you've been shown? Like, is proof enough for you? And for Abram, it is, and it drives him mad. I think there are things that we believe, but we don't really follow to their logical conclusions, because I love animals, and I still eat meat. I think like eventually I'll be a vegetarian, and eventually I'll probably also be a vegan, but I don't have the wherewithal to do that just quite yet, you know, and then until then I have this kind of contradiction between what I claim to believe and my actions. And I think Abram is a very pure character in the way that he learns of what's going on. I'm speaking kind of in a roundabout way to not spoil it. He learns what has been happening and he does put all of his eggs in that basket, and the conclusions that he gets to are horrifying. And rather than finding a way to convince himself otherwise, it drives him insane, right? He follows those conclusions to their logical end, and he realizes that that he has to act in a way that is unintelligible unless you totally believe.
Yes, when we get to the end of that chapter, we're feeling a little bit shell-shocked. And then you have, if there's a villain in this, it's the Colonel. And we don't need to talk about the Colonel, but he's clearly the villain.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the villain is, I mean, he's this kind of personified military logic, right? Where he's looking at grand strategy. He has a charge to defend the homeland. He has a very clear sense of kind of what he considers to be right and wrong. And I think, I mean, there are people like that everywhere, but when you get people like that in the military, they suddenly have at their disposal, you know, billions of dollars and the capacity to form the world through violence into their image. And I think that's what we see in the Colonel. The Colonel is also kind of a family member as well. And so we have this kind of tension between what is demanded of him as a family member and what is demanded of him by this distant power of government and statecraft.
You do very well at dancing around giving away stuff. That's good. I like that.
I'm being very precise.
You're doing very well. Tom Lynn joins us. His book is Babylon, South Dakota. And if you're reading this book and you don't fall in love with this family, I find it almost impossible to believe that you wouldn't. And their daughter, we get to watch her from birth right up until, well, she becomes ancient, actually, in this from the way you wrote it. She is just such an amazing person. We just love her so much.
Yeah, and she, I mean, she is a character that is based on, and you know, from kind of little stories and moments cribbed from my mother and from my grandmother's, and kind of put together into this amalgam that is then placed on these barren South Dakota plains. I think the thing about Mara that I really admire is that she, I mean, whereas her father, Saul, is so worried that he isn't good, I think Mara believes wholeheartedly and really can't be convinced otherwise that the world is full of good people and that good things will happen to good people. And I think, like, in the beginning when we meet her, it seems almost like a childish, naive faith. And I think throughout the course of the book, we see that she is, if not proven right, at least she feels vindicated to have these beliefs. And things don't always go her way, and she does suffer really great tragedies, but she's animated by this belief that things are okay somewhere, and that what is required of her is that she continues to believe and that she continues to be good.
Another intriguing aspect of this is language. And we have Mara, who she is exposed to different languages, and I'll leave that for readers to discover how this happens. It's really quite bizarre. And early on, they're like, how did she learn French? and then we have this other family member who develops a unique language. Tell us about your fascination with language.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is a fascination which has actually been really interesting to kind of articulate in this age of algorithmically generated language, which is, I think for me, language is the interface between minds. It's the only way that we can really talk to one another, and yet it seems that we're able to refer to things outside of ourselves. We're able to point at stuff and describe it. We can use it to invoke time. We can mess with time and language. It has always struck me as kind of the most powerful tool that we have for changing our own experience of the world. And at the same time, it's a thing which has to be done in community, right? The character that you mentioned who develops his own language, I think I was inspired by these stories of identical twins, like apocryphal stories, where they develop their own lingua franca between the two of them. And so they're able to communicate with each other long before they're able to communicate with anybody else who speaks a recognized language. And I've always been kind of fascinated by this idea that we as humans are begging to speak. Like we desire nothing more absolutely than to communicate and be understood, and that there are these things, you know, which intercede in that comprehension. That Mara could speak French and her parents wouldn't understand her, but even, you know, in a very real sense, like the children of immigrants speak the language of the new country far better than their parents ever can. And the way that then becomes transmuted into a kind of power, right? Like as a child, I remember like translating letters from, you know, like from this or that government agency, translating them for my parents. And I was like, you know, like first or second grade. But my English was at the point where I could understand these letters better than my parents could. And so there was a way, and, you know, I would go to like, I went to a parent teacher conference, I remember in elementary school, and I was translating for my mother. The teacher would tell me stuff about myself, and then I would turn to my mother and I would translate into Chinese. And so there's a way in which like language is something that we get to use. It's a privilege that is afforded to us, but it's afforded to us by community. And the thing about language is that to speak it is to expect that someday you will be understood. And I think, you know, there's nothing more, I think, heart-wrenching for people who write, right? That they can write something and that someone will take the time and read the whole thing. Like, that to me is such a profound privilege, and I don't take that very lightly. And that's why I think it takes me so long to write anything, because I'm so aware of what I'm asking of the reader, which is to sit with my words and to hear me for, you know, the whole book, and to come away having understood something of that.
Well, in the end, it's very rewarding. And of course, as we're reading, we're going, now how on earth is he going to end this thing? But I thought the ending was fantastic. I loved it. And I was really puzzled over how you were going to be able to pull it all together. But you do, you pull it off. And I was picturing you just now as you described those parent-teacher conferences and the teacher saying one thing and you kind of sanitizing it for your parents in translation. I'm sure you didn't do that.
You know, that part is not available to me in memory. Who knows? I think I was honest.
Okay, I'm sure you were. I'm sure you're a good kid. Okay, Tom, so what kind of stuff do you like to read?
I mostly read nonfiction, actually. I do love fiction, but I find myself most drawn to nonfiction. It's like very, very niche, detailed explanations of things. I think it affords me more material to think with. And so right now I'm reading a book called Kindred, but it's not the one by Octavia Butler. It is about Neanderthals and like their culture. And I think we have this, I mean, I did at least, this image of like the caveman as being like a dumb brute who kind of bashes rocks together. And the book is by Rebecca Ragg Sykes. But in this book about Kindred, I mean, we have evidence that they had communities, that they loved one another, that they buried their dead, right? That they had fire, they had furniture, and this is 200,000 years ago. I'm fascinated by encounters with deep time and with like alien intelligence, which I think Neanderthal intelligence is an alien intelligence for us. And then prior to this, I was reading Other Minds by Peter Godfrey Smith, which is about cephalopod intelligence. And so I think I'm on a recent kick of otherworldly intelligence. But yeah, I mostly read nonfiction.
I like it. And that way, you're not really influenced by fiction, are you?
I mean, I do certainly have fiction influences. I think I draw a lot from John Steinbeck and from, you know, Jorge Luis Borges, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the kind of magical realist tradition, as well as I've always really loved the work of the Hungarian writer Laszlo Krasznahorkai. And up until a few years ago, that was a really kind of like, if you know, you know, kind of thing to say. And then he won the Nobel Prize, Herman Melville. And kind of this, I think of Herman Melville as one of the great makers of American literature as a kind of literary identity. I'm obsessed with Moby Dick. I think it's one of the greatest books ever written. And I'm actually looking at my bookshelf right now, and I'm looking at not only Moby Dick, but also the companion volume that I have to it, and then the three books on whaling that I have next to it, and then the biography of Melville, and then all of his other books. Yeah, I have a whole Melville section.
Nice. So is Babylon an homage to a writer?
I think of it as such an evocative name for a place. And I think I was very inspired by, originally the air base in the novel was called Clarendon, which was kind of a nothing name. It's just the placeholder. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to give it a kind of name that had gravity and kind of years behind it. And then when I got to Babylon as the name, it immediately felt right. And it kind of clicked into place.
And before I let you go, you've joined us on the telephone from Iowa City, where you're a faculty member at the University of Iowa. How did you end up in Iowa?
I've always really admired the literary output that comes out of Iowa. I was applying for jobs after my PhD a few years ago, and I came here and I did a campus visit. And while I was here, I did my little talk, and then I answered questions, and then they took me out to a wonderful dinner. And then at the dinner, one of my now colleagues said, the thing that I can tell you about Iowa City is that this is the last place possibly on earth where writing is, where writers are rock stars. And I was like, that's like, I'm sold. And it really is true. Everybody in this town is writing a book. It's kind of remarkable to be surrounded by this level of productivity and kind of literary intensity. And it's very gratifying and motivating. Writing is such a monkish, antisocial, like solipsistic activity. And to realize that you can do it in community with other writers, I think for me was a revelation. And I do love the wide open spaces of the Midwest. I'm learning to love the summers and the winters, but I love the people here and the way that they think about writing.
Well, in my youth, when I still lived in Des Moines, we used to make pilgrimages up to Iowa City, and we'd go and we'd just hang out outside the house where Kurt Vonnegut lived when he was there for the Writer's Workshop. And we go to the bar where Dylan Thomas used to drink, places like that, or we go hang out at the Vine where T.C. Boyle used to hang out, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. That kind of like whatever genius residue stuck to the walls might transmit itself by osmosis into us.
We really felt that way, and I think I still do.
It's very humbling to kind of be in the place where so much of literature was made. I feel bad. I think the Vonnegut House, I think people live there, like a regular family lives there. And I do kind of feel for them that they must have just a parade of kind of awestruck visitors constantly passing by their front door.
I love that. Well, Tom, it's really been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Vic, so much. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Tom Lind. The book is Babylon, South Dakota. You heard about it in the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.